Welcome to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Is there such a thing as a DUI law that's too harsh? In a few minutes, you'll meet two Washington lawmakers who agree on a lot, but have different solutions to the problem of impaired driving. I hope you can stay tuned for that. First, our top story today. Business leaders are meeting with Seattle city officials this afternoon to discuss what is going on with the streetcar. You will recall Mayor Jenny Durkan is a month past her due date for a decision on whether to continue the streetcar expansion. The expansion would connect the lines at South Lake Union and First Hill right through downtown Seattle. KUOW reporter Carolyn Adolph has been following this story. Welcome, Carolyn.
Well, hello.
Remind us, will you, what is the holdup with the streetcar?
The holdup is that this is a $177 million project that is already in the red to the tune of $23 million without a rail line on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's over budget already, and there are big questions about whether this is going to be worth the investment to build it and the public money that's going to be required to operate it. There's this internal review, and it includes the city budget office and the transportation department. And then the mayor has also hired this accounting firm, KPMG, and she's had them in and out of her office a few times. So all of this has been going on, though, kind of out of public sight while we're awaiting a decision.
And many businesses are keenly awaiting that decision. They'd like to know what's going to happen here. And I said there's a meeting today. What are they discussing?
Well, they're going to be discussing, I mean, the businesses have been there, are going to be going there because they've been pounding on the door for months trying to get input into this. I mean, we're talking about a broad coalition of businesses, everybody from Vulcan Real Estate to merchants in Chinatown and Pioneer Square.
So they don't just want to know what's going to happen. They have a very keen interest in lobbying for certain outcomes here.
They have things to say. They want to lobby for an outcome that they believe they were promised.
Mm-hmm.
And that's this connector line that's going to run between the two completely disconnected lines, First Hill and South Lake Union. They're saying, look, yeah, the system's not working so well now, but with the connector, we can start to move tourists to Pioneer Square. There's so much more we can do, and you promised. But they've been trying to get this foot in the door, and they can't get a meeting with the mayor. And when they write a letter to the mayor, a deputy mayor responds. They're just apoplectic.
Horrors.
Horrors. What, we're chopped liver now? What is this?
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so they just want to get into the mayor's office, they say, and help.
Mm-hmm.
Don Blakeney is the vice president of advocacy at the Downtown Seattle Association. And he says he knows the mayor's got a complex choice ahead, but the business community was promised this streetcar.
How do you look at the realities of budgeting and increased costs for construction, but also maintain that integrity and those promises that were made? It takes creative thinking and leadership, and I think it's totally possible to do, but it takes bringing the community together to figure out how to solve these things.
So today they're not really getting that, though. They're going to get a meeting with another deputy mayor and the interim head of the city transport department. And so, you know, but they might get some insight as to what the big holdup is. What are some of the deep issues that all of these reviews may be uncovering? We simply don't know.
Well, you told us the city has hired this accounting firm. Mm. And what do we know about how this accounting firm is reviewing the streetcar bidding?
Well, we don't know very much, actually. We know that they have made a forecast for how much the connector line is going to make the whole system be more effective. But why, again, is an accounting firm reviewing a transportation project that hasn't been 100% explained? Is this a flag? So what triggered that? There are a lot of questions. And the city budget office, that's an interesting place to get input because they've been predicting a decline in construction revenue. So that's a larger discussion as well. Is there going to be money to pay for this thing going forward?
As the Seattle boom inevitably cools a bit and construction revenue slows. Uh-huh.
Right.
So the mayor's office is meeting with these businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And does that indicate to us that maybe there is finally an overdue decision coming on the streetcar?
Well, it doesn't necessarily. It could just be an attempt to mollify and calm the grumbling. I want you to hear some of the grumbling. This is Keith Kyle. Now, he's not from the business community. He's the executive director of Seattle Subway, and he's a transit advocate. But I met him at the Downtown Seattle Association. They called him in.
This is entirely a black box. How this decision is being made, who the mayor is listening to, what's even really going on, we don't have any idea of any of the answers to those questions. And that's a big concern when this has been a public issue this long, to still not have those answers.
And that nervousness has been accentuated by the city's announcement that it's starting to put back parking spaces it took away, anticipating construction of the streetcar line.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it was pending a decision about the connector. So that does not sound like good news to Keith Kyle. Also, due to the good influence of KUOW, we put some pressure on them. Seattle released full ridership data.
Uh-huh.
That shows that there has, you know, right now the two streetcar lines are moving 5,000 people on average a day. That's about the same as they were moving 2 years ago. So that's, you know, that isn't the most stellar thing. Of course, advocates like Keith Kyle say the connector will change everything.
Yes. So the mayor's office is having this meeting, and there are some questions about what the mayor's thinking on this. Why is it so hard to know what she's going to do, get that meeting with the mayor? And Carolyn, you were struck by something that Mayor Durkan said recently.
Right, and it was right in front of you and me and the listeners of The Record. You know, she came on The Record in April, a month after putting this streetcar project on hold, and she was talking about how the city was fiscally off the rails, mm-hmm, because it was set to spend beyond its means for the next 2 years.
We have been planning for reducing our budget since I walked in the door.
Yes.
I've asked every one of my department heads to give me a budget that was lower, and we're even paring that back, because if we look at the projections going forward, we know we have to live within our means. So we have to be looking out at a 3- and 5-year scenario. So yes, it's going to be the year of fiscal discipline.
What is the biggest budget cut coming?
I wouldn't say the biggest budget cut, but I would say you will see across all departments reductions.
I'm so glad you asked about that biggest budget cut question,
mm-hmm,
because look what it revealed. It's a 3- to 5-year reduction scenario, reductions across departments, but not necessarily budget. That means stuff like projects. Mm-hmm. The streetcar's caught up in this, and it's a signal of a big tidal shift. You know, this gravy train that we've had with this boom is starting to grind to a halt, and it's going to have consequences, possibly for the Seattle streetcar.
That's KUOW reporter Carolyn Adolph. Carolyn, thanks a lot for that.
Hey, fun.
And if you'd like some more details in the story, and it really is a story, you can think of it that way, right? We have an interview airing soon. It's a natural history of the Seattle streetcar from pre-1900 to where, as Carolyn just described, where we are today with that streetcar line. Stay tuned to The Record on KUOW. You're listening to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Look, nobody wants people killed on the road by impaired drivers. The question is, what's the best way to reduce those crashes? And we're going to talk about that now. Is tougher penalties the way to go? Is there a different, better way? And I have two guests here, Republican State Senator Mike Padden from Spokane Valley in eastern Washington. He'd like to toughen our laws so that 3 DUI convictions, not 4, but 3, would equal a felony. Welcome, Senator Padden.
Well, welcome. Good to be on your program.
Good to have you. And Democratic State Representative Roger Goodman of Kirkland says there are better solutions than tougher prison sentences. Welcome, Representative Goodman.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
And I want to say that you are not opposites here debating each other. You've worked together on this issue.
Absolutely.
Yeah?
We've been working together for years.
Yeah, and successfully, we've been able to get a number of pieces of legislation through both the House and Senate and signed by the governor.
Yeah.
Well, I think you can both agree that safety is a goal, but there are other issues that come into this. Senator Padden, as I said, current law in Washington makes 4 DUI convictions a felony. Why don't you start by telling us why it's better to reduce that to just 3 DUI convictions?
Well, we're still higher than most other states. Both Oregon and Idaho require 3, and I think 3 is important to get down to that, because we know that the people that continually have DUIs are the most likely to end up having vehicular assaults or worse, vehicular homicides. And while I support going down to three. I think even more important right now, immediately, would be to extend the look-back provision, which currently is at 10 years. So right now you've got to have four DUIs within 10 years. And we just had this terrible case over there in Snohomish County, this Aaron Gentry, who had six, I guess this would be a sixth prior DUI, but they weren't within the 10-year period. And, well, it's true he's going to be charged with vehicular homicide. If he had not killed somebody and simply had another DUI going 90 miles an hour the wrong way on I-5, we wouldn't have been able to send him to prison, and I think that's important. So I think both are important, but I would have to say the look back is a higher priority right now than going from four to three on the number of DUIs to cause a felony.
And Representative Roger Goodman of Kirkland, what do you think of reducing the number of convictions from four to three to equal a felony and narrowing that 10-year window when those have to occur?
I agree with Senator Patton that the look back, the so-called look back period, is more important right now to capture more DUIs over a longer period of time, people who have clearly a very disturbing long-term pattern of DUIs. And so that's probably more important than reducing the number from four down to three. The only concern I have, and a number of other legislators, is the fiscal effect. There's a lot of DUIs every year. There's almost 40,000 arrests every year. That's a lot. And so
how much more expensive would Senator Patton's idea be?
Well, I don't know the exact numbers, but we're talking about ultimately over a period of years, tens of millions of dollars, but building a new prison, basically. And so that's prohibitive, and it's unfortunately a political impediment to getting tougher this way.
Senator Patton, where would we get, what would we cut to spend tens of millions of dollars on being tougher on DUIs?
Yeah, we really don't have to cut anything. We have increased revenue. We have the best economy in the country, according to a recent survey. So there's revenues coming in. Every revenue forecast recently, we've exceeded the projections. What we need to do is make it a higher priority, public safety. And this is a battle that Roger and I have had on these issues and other issues such as domestic violence. We're trying to get tougher penalties. Is the resistance to having even one additional bed in the system. Now, there's ways to do this, I think, that could be more cost-effective. And we looked at one time on DUIs, instead of maybe having them at the state prison, have the state prison contract, say, with Yakima. They have a jail over there that has a yard and has educational facilities, everything. It would probably be okay for DUIs who are not considered as violent as other offenders that are in the system. So we want to be smart. We want to keep the costs down. But at some point, we've got to say, hey, this is a higher priority, and we've got to get it in the budget.
Representative Goodman, what is a more affordable way to reduce impaired driving?
So Senator Patton is right. There are other states, Texas and Illinois, I can think of, that have other specialized facilities that are not necessarily high security, but focus more on the underlying problem, which is alcohol dependence, where these offenders get treatment. And it's sort of, I guess, less punitive. Needless to say, they are confined to a secure facility, but it's specialized for drunk drivers. So that's a possibility. I mean, we still are talking about some expense here, and I agree with Senator Patton. It should be the highest priority to keep our roadways safe. But in the meanwhile, we really have saved a lot of lives through other measures. We have these ignition interlock devices, the breathalyzer in the car, and we've expanded that program for the last 10 years and been able to cut deaths and serious injuries in half. So we've made a lot of progress, but there's always tragedies out there. As people who have serious drinking problems and they just can't control it and they break the law, and but we are making some progress.
How does somebody who wants to drive get around the breathalyzer?
They violate the law. I mean, basically, if you are arrested, or if your license is suspended, or if you're convicted, we require you to put this breathalyzer in the car. If there's alcohol, the car doesn't start. It's connected to the ignition. And there's somewhere between 25 and 30,000 of these devices in the cars across the state. And so those cars don't get on the road, particularly during the weekend. So we've saved hundreds, possibly thousands of lives in the last decade. But there's only about 70% compliance. So there's 30% of the people who are supposed to have these devices. They're known drunk drivers, and they just don't put it in the car. And so they're committing a crime by doing that. They're just taking a chance. And then, as I said, we have these tragedies by people who just keep doing it and aren't complying with the law.
Yeah, Bill, this Gentry fellow, he actually borrowed somebody else's car and was using that going the wrong way.
Right.
Of course, was supposed to have the interlock. I commend Representative Goodman. He's focused on a whole number of issues, including the interlock, and we've been able to work together, and these things are not mutually exclusive or anything.
That's right.
We need to look at this from a number of different fronts.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways we can crack down on DUIs. The first is cultural change. Just it's not funny. It's not acceptable. It used to be stand around the water cooler and say, oh, yeah, I ended up in a ditch last night. Well, that's not funny anymore. Grassroots organizations like Mothers Against Drunk Driving have made a lot of progress in changing that conversation. As I say, the Ignition Interlock program is working very well. Senator Patton has pushed forward the reducing the number of DUIs so that it's a felony sooner. The controversial one are roadside checkpoints.
Right.
And roadside checkpoints are constitutionally questionable in Washington State because it's deemed to be a violation of our privacy when you're inside the vehicle compartment. The police can't just be sort of looking at you. Other states do have these roadside checkpoints.
How many deaths do you think and injuries would a roadside checkpoint prevent?
Well, the research shows somewhere between a 25% and 35% reduction in deaths and serious injuries if we had the roadside checkpoint. So even more effective than the ignition interlock devices, these breathalyzers. So we're struggling with it, though. Senator Patton and I we co-chaired a task force years ago, and it was one of the recommendations, but legislatively we couldn't get it done.
Senator Patton, what do you think of reducing serious injuries or deaths by 25% to 30%, but with the what some people think is an invasion of privacy, a random roadside checkpoint?
Well, I really think there are some constitutional concerns about those, but I mean, it is something we can do. You know, more of the enhanced enforcement that the State Patrol does, and they are very targeted. They look at the data, they see where it's most likely to happen, and I think that can help. Until I think we can clear up the constitutional question, I think we're going to have a problem in this state on the roadside checkpoints, even though it may be very worthwhile. But I think there are some constitutional issues.
I agree. I mean, we've been trying to work our way around it, maybe give people notice that the police will be at this particular place at this particular time. But every time we try it, it runs into our state constitution protects privacy to a much greater degree than the federal constitution. And so, but as Senator Patton says, these emphasis patrols where law enforcement know the particular corridors of road where drunk drivers frequent, particularly on the weekends, that is also effective.
Could either of you see high-tech cars sending data to the government about swerving and erratic behavior?
I guess. I mean, ultimately, I suppose cars will be driving us around rather than our driving them.
But right.
That's pretty far in the future, I have to say. And then we do have Uber and Lyft, and we have... There's a lot of establishments, bars have breathalyzers in their facilities where you blow before you leave.
Before you go, blow before you go.
Hand them the keys. So again,
right, and I think down the road some of the new vehicles will actually have detectors in the car. If there's ambient air that is beyond a certain point, it may have the interlock in there. So technology probably can help us in the future, but it's not immediate.
That's true, actually. Some of the car automakers, and from Japan in particular, are working really hard on these alcohol detection systems. Even like in a convertible, in open air, the car can detect alcohol and won't start. And so we are getting closer to that, where a car can detect alcohol and you can't get on the road that way.
You are listening to the voice of Democratic State Representative Roger Goodman of Kirkland. We've also been talking with Republican State Senator Mike Padden, who's interested in reducing the number of DUI convictions that that equals a felony, down from 4 to 3, and also increasing the window that you could catch you could catch up DUI convictions to add up to that felony conviction, the so-called look back window. And I appreciate both of you talking this through. Senator Padden from Spokane Valley in Eastern Washington, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Goodman, thanks a lot for this.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle, and we're going to talk about Godwin's Law, the axiom about how quickly you jump to a Hitler comparison. Is it time to rethink that law? We're going to talk with Godwin and a UW professor in just a moment. You're listening to The Record on KUOW, and we're live tweeting the program at KUOW, so join us on Twitter. Remember when this happened in 2016?
I've never done this before. Can I have a pledge, a swearing? Raise your right hand. I do solemnly swear that I, no matter how I feel, no matter what the conditions, if there's hurricanes or whatever, will vote on or before the 12th for Donald J. Trump for president. Thank you. Now I know.
You may remember some of the headlines the following day comparing the arm-raising Trump rally to scenes from Nazi Germany. And there have, of course, been other Trump-Hitler comparisons since, when he called for a Muslim ban, when he said some white nationalists are good people, when he separated migrant children from their parents at the border. Now, some people say comparing Trump to Hitler is overheated or it's lazy. And those critics might invoke Godwin's Law, which says, as an online discussion continues, the probability of a comparison to Hitler or to Nazis approaches one. Is it time to reconsider Godwin's Law? Well, let's ask Godwin. Mike Godwin is the lawyer and the writer who came up with this axiom in 1990. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Will you remind us what point you were making when you made your Hitler comparison observation?
Sure. Well, let me tell you what point I wasn't making. Uh-huh. First, I wasn't telling people not to ever compare anyone to Hitler or to Nazis, but I was asking people or trying to urge them to do it thoughtfully and with an eye to real history, so that you don't do it just because you're mad at somebody, but you do it because you make that comparison to Hitler or to Nazis because you think it's really meaningful and it's substantially true. But of course, you know, the internet, when you say things on the internet, people, you know, sometimes they love what you say and then they use it for their own purposes. And some people, more in fun than in anything else, have said that when you get to the Hitler comparison, the discussion is over or you've done something wrong. I don't think that's always true.
Okay, yes. You're not saying that you violated some law by bringing up Hitler at all. You're saying be thoughtful about it. And I wonder, decades on from when you came up with the phrase, with Godwin's Law, how do you think about how Hitler comparisons are used today? Where would you use such a comparison?
Well, so I have a lot of thoughts about this, but I'll try, you know, in the interest of time, to keep them to one or two. And one of them is that the idea of remembering history and keeping in mind, you know, who Hitler was and what the Nazis were, and not making the comparisons frivolously, is what enables us nowadays to make meaningful comparisons if we see things like the rise of Duterte in the Philippines or of Hun Sen in Cambodia, and we say, well, that's a terrible movement in the direction of authoritarianism and dictatorship, and so we should do those comparisons. The thing that makes it meaningful is that we don't throw those comparisons around unless we are really historically grounded when we do it. That's the idea.
And Mike, you've said that Godwin's Law is about remembering history well enough to draw a parallel. So let's bring in someone who does that professionally, Professor Lori Marhofer, University of Washington historian of Weimar and Nazi Germany. Good to have you back, Professor.
Hey, thanks, Bill.
Thanks for coming. Do you know one another, by the way, Professor and Mike Godwin?
No.
We haven't met. No.
Well, I'm glad to bring you together in this exact, you know, a productive discussion. Let me start generally with you, Professor Marhofer. What's your reaction to Nazi-Hitler comparisons and Godwin's law?
Well, I think it's interesting thinking about Godwin's law in the 90s and how self-evident that was and how we are in a different moment now where we're struggling for ways to talk about the far right. My experience of the 1990s was under the impression that it wasn't so relevant in this country. And now looking back, I think that was mistaken. But certainly now a lot more people see the extreme racist authoritarian right as far more important in our politics. And I think that people are trying to find ways to talk about it, you know, to talk about Charlottesville. There were people at Charlottesville who were frankly Nazis. Self-identified.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. So there's
sometimes
no problem.
We talk about people misusing the term Nazi, and there's some confusion about that.
Yeah, neo-Nazis are Nazis. I think it would be doing them a disservice to say otherwise.
Why is that? I mean, the Nazis, that was literally a party at one time. When we say neo-Nazi, I assume we're saying that these are people who weren't born then or responding to very different conditions, and it may be useful to compare them to Nazis, but that a neo-Nazi is not literally a Nazi, and we should be careful, no? But you're the historian.
Nazism is a form of fascism. It's the German variant of fascism, and it's a particular political philosophy. Mm-hmm. You can get books out of the library and read the major principles of fascism, like liberalism or communism. There is an intellectual tradition that existed after 1945, and there are Americans today who find it, you know, very useful and who self-identify with it.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy ran for president on the Nazi Party ticket in the 20th century in the Pacific Northwest. That guy was a Nazi, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. Yes, so, self-identified.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're talking with Mike Godwin, the writer and lawyer who sort of coined the idea, Godwin's Law, it came to be called. And I should remind you, in case you're just tuning in, that as an online discussion continues, the probability of a comparison to Hitler or to Nazis approaches one. And you were being sort of jocular there, I think, Mike, saying about how we can rush to an overheated or a lazy comparison. But has your thinking changed on that today?
Well, so I think that the natural human tendency when people have access to the internet and a lot of different voices and they're talking to each other on Facebook or on Twitter, especially if they don't have a generation or two of experience doing that, people get angry at each other. People learn that other people have really different opinions. And there's a tendency, I think, for when you're really exposed to a diversity of opinion and points of view to get frustrated and angry about it and to want to escalate the rhetoric. So I think that tendency is there. Much as I love the internet, I think it has enabled that tendency to be more accelerated. So I think that Godwin's Law identified that phenomenon, and I think it's still around today, especially as more and more people are join the first generation of people to get on the internet. You know, we really only have about half the population of the world at most online. So we've got another 3.5 billion people who are going to come online, and they're going to have the same learning curve that we all have had. And they'll get in arguments, and they'll meet, you know, they'll compare people to Hitler or, you know, Pol Pot or Stalin. All those comparisons are going to happen.
Well, Professor Marhofer, there's a debate now about whether the Republican Congress should move to restrict Trump more, hold hearings, pass laws restricting what he can do, block his nominees. Is it fair to warn Republicans about how Germany's leadership accommodated Hitler in his early years? Is that a fair warning, you think? You know, politics aside, just from a historian's point of view.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of what historians do that's useful is offer points of comparison to what's going on today. So I wouldn't want to close down thoughtful, careful consideration of continuities like what Mike is talking about. I think that more useful comparisons than Germany in 1933 are, you know, Putin in 2000 or Duterte or some of these more recent examples of countries where a democratic government was slowly eaten away from within by the erosion of both formal legal norms, so voter suppression, for example, or vote rigging, And the erosion of informal norms. If you think about what happened with the Obama's last Supreme Court appointee and how that appointment was denied, nothing was illegal there, but that was a real breach of protocol up to that point that had a real effect. You know, the drawing of congressional districts in a way that favors one party over another. All of these things that I've talked about are things you can see in other countries in the second half of the 20th century, where a democratic regime slowly became an authoritarian one. And I'm convinced by political science. There's a great book about this called How Democracies Die that came out recently, but I'm really convinced by that those are the more important points of comparison and indeed warning for Republicans in Congress. Yeah. Than 33 in Germany.
I like that book too. And I think one of the things that it really underscores is that democracies are inherently fragile. That is to say, because democracies try to give everyone a voice, some of the voices will be anti-democratic voices. And so there's always the potential for a democracy, no matter how well designed it is, to be undercut by anti-democratic voices that take advantage of democratic institutions. And the United States, I think, we've had this dream of ourselves as being institutionally immune to that problem. But I don't see that we are. You know, Sinclair Lewis, the novelist, wrote a book in the 1930s called "It Can't Happen Here." And it was about the creation of a fascist state after the Roosevelt administration in the 1930s. And it reads as quite credible to me, and it's not about Nazis at all. It's about how fragile democratic institutions can be when there are populist impulses that want to undercut them.
Well, sometimes in a discussion, it's handy to have a powerful symbol that you can pull out and get people's attention. Mike, if we want to, let's say we're having an online discussion, or I suppose an in-person one, if you want to alarm, if you want to raise concerns about the gradual erosion of norms, the rule of law, as we said, voting rights, you know, enemies lists, what is a better argumentative tool or image than Hitler?
Well, so I've given this a lot of thought, and I think I should confess that one of the reasons I came up with Godwin's Law is I felt that temptation in myself from time to time before I invented Godwin's Law to make those comparisons when I saw, you know, authoritarian impulses in the online world. I think the trick to this is not how to figure out the right hammer to hammer your opponent with or the right comparison. I think if you're arguing with someone who is amenable to finding common ground, then I think one of the things we have to learn is to very self-consciously engage in a lot of what are called alternative dispute resolution strategies, which is to find, you know, to restate other people's point of view in ways that make it clear that you understand them, so that they're heard. And one of the things that I've found, and I think other people have found online, is that if the people you're arguing with feel that they've been heard, they sometimes are more willing to hear a different point of view. And that, I think, is ultimately going to be the way we restore the common ground that underlies American democracy.
Well, that's very interesting. Professor, can you look at history and point to examples of where not being alarmist, but instead hearing other parties, letting them know they've been heard, you know, restating their point of view, have you found that to be useful in keeping societies on the rails?
Yeah, I think if democracies are fragile and they work best when there's a general commitment to democratic principles that people adhere to above their commitments to winning whatever their political goals are. So living in a democracy means compromising, and it does mean allowing other people to have their say and listening.
But do you have a message for someone who's saying, do you know someone who, or do you see people in Seattle crossing the line, whether it's, you know, I don't know, this is not my president, or, you know, is anything overheated in the debate, the anti-Trump resistance?
Well, I think there are two things going on. I think that, fascism, German fascism, Nazism in the United States has come to stand in for the ultimate evil, and that when people are in online chat rooms or when my father-in-law is frustrated because he got a ticket for wearing his seatbelt improperly, there's an impulse to pull out your nuclear weapon and talk about fascism. And, you know, I think Godwin's made some good points about that. And then I think people are also watching the rise of the populist authoritarian right around the world right now. The right that we're seeing in the United States, there are certainly factions of it that are neo-Nazi, but a lot of it is not that similar to fascism at all. But I think people don't have ways to talk about it, and their frame of reference is Nazism, so they go back to that. Nazism was also a populist right authoritarian movement, although it was very different from what we're seeing. I do think it's... you know, it's interesting to chew this over, but I also think people should be careful. I would not compare the clip that you played of Trump asking people to promise to vote for him. I would not compare that to anything that Hitler did. I thought that's the kind of comparison to Nazism that I...
There was the raising the right hand bit. He did ask them to raise their right hands.
He did. But there's lots of other... Hitler was also a vegetarian. I don't... right. You know, and he loved dogs. I don't think...
That's right.
I mean, there's... Yeah, I really agree with you that you have to be very careful and you have to be able to back up your point. And I think there are, you know, thinking about the upcoming elections, there are people who kind of lean Trump but are moderate who I think get enraged when leftists compare Trump to Hitler. And I think strategically leftists ought to be a little bit careful about it.
We're not telling you, declaring that it's right or wrong to evoke historical comparisons, but we are urging you to be thoughtful and historical and proportional, and we'll try to keep our democratic norms together here. We've been talking about this so-called Godwin's Law with Mike Godwin, the lawyer and writer who came up with his observation about Hitler comparisons back in 1990. Mike, thank you for this.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thanks so much.
And Professor Lori Marhofer, assistant history professor, University of Washington, and she studies just that, Weimar Germany and Nazi Germany. Good to see you again, and I bet we'll talk again. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be here. Thanks, Bill.
Stay tuned for more of The Record on KUOW. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. It's your first big presentation, or you're negotiating a salary for the first time, or you're finally getting promoted. Have you ever felt that maybe you're not qualified for something at work and everybody's eventually going to find out? If you have felt that way, then you've experienced imposter syndrome. The latest episode of KUOW's podcast, Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace, is about imposter syndrome, and host Jeannie Yandel is here with me now. Hi, Jeannie.
Hello.
And I want to ask, by the way, of listeners, right? I thought we could ask listeners, because I think a lot of us have imposter syndrome stories, right?
Yes, yes. Recent research says that 80% of us experience it at some point in our lives. 80% of us.
That's all.
Yes.
So give us a call, will you? And join this discussion. Tell your story, and we're figuring out what to do about it. Our number is 206-543-5869. We're also on Twitter, at KUOW. Again, the phone number, 206-543-5869. So let's lay the groundwork, Jeannie. Remind us, I said a little bit, but tell us more about imposter syndrome.
Yeah, so it's this feeling of basically not being qualified, that you are doing something or about to do something that you are not prepared for, that you're not smart enough for, that you're not qualified for. And moreover, once you start doing the thing, everybody else is going to realize that you do not belong, that you should not be in that position, which is terrifying.
Yes, it is. And relatable. You said, I mean, your podcast is about the sexist workplace, but you talk on the episode about how this is not just something that affects women.
No, not at all. It's we even found a gentleman in England who has written a bunch of poetry about experiencing imposter syndrome, and we featured a little bit in the episode. Mm-hmm. But it is a really, really common occurrence.
Common, but also true that it falls disproportionately on women. True to say?
It is true to say. That's what a lot of the research that we looked at says. There are kind of two ways that it falls on women harder, right? One is it's reinforced more frequently, meaning that, you know, women and particularly women of color don't see leaders like who look like them or, you know, who have similar backstories to them. They're just not put in positions of power as frequently. So there's that kind of reinforcement of like, oh, well, if I'm feeling like this and there's nobody like me out there, well, maybe there's something there, even though that's not necessarily accurate. It's easy to feel that way. But then the consequence piece of it is that women are less likely to sort of go after things if they don't feel qualified. For example, women are less likely to apply for jobs unless they feel they're 100% qualified for those jobs. And the research says that men in general don't have that same issue, which means if fewer women are applying for the job than men, it's easy to see who's going to get the job.
Sure. Negotiating a raise on
exactly.
and on.
Yeah.
Just getting the work done that
just
you want to get
done
at work.
Yes. You know, raising your hand,
yeah.
high profile stuff. It's just, you know, if you've got that voice in your head saying, oh, you're not ready for this yet. It's easy to listen to that voice.
Can you you start the episode, which I really appreciated, you know, back in your childhood, and there's the sound of a Catholic mass.
Yes.
Do you and listeners can go listen to the latest episode. It's there where you get your podcasts, Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace. Do you have more of a grown-up workplace memory? Maybe it's pretty recent. I don't know. But have you had imposter syndrome in your professional life?
I have had imposter syndrome in my professional life a number of times. And I thought about, I've even had it in my personal life a number of times. Two examples came to mind. I was filling in as a host once here on KUOW, and I had to interview the Indian Bill Gates. And I was like, there is legitimately no way this dude is going to walk into this room and look at me and think this is an interviewer I should take seriously. So I read his entire 450-page book twice. So I felt like I was at minimum a little prepared to have a conversation with him.
Mm-hmm.
That was not necessary. I ended up asking a ton of overly detailed questions.
Mm.
I think the overpreparation did not help me.
Right.
So that's one example. Another example is I was at a parent-teacher conference for my kindergartner recently, and the teacher asked me, well, what would you like to do to ensure your child's academic success? And I was like, I don't know. I just birthed a child and now I'm responsible for that child. I don't have any ideas for this. And I imagined that this teacher would listen to me hem and haw and not have an answer, tell all of the other teachers, tell the principal, and then I would be judged as a really basically a poor parent. I had this fear for weeks afterwards. My partner had to actually talk me down.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking about imposter syndrome, and this is Jeannie Yandel, one of the hosts of the show, the podcast, Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace. And I want to give the phone number again in case you want to join us. We'd like to hear if you have a personal story of feeling experiencing imposter syndrome, because we're going to talk about what to do about it. Our phone number is 206-543-5869, 206-543-5869. Here's a voicemail we got from a listener named Judith talking about her imposter syndrome experience.
Hi, my name is Judith Tingley, and I live on Bainbridge Island. I am a retired psychologist, and when I finished my PhD, I went into private practice, and early on, a person came in who was delusional, and I said to myself, oh, good golly, this person needs to see a psychologist. Hmm. And then I paused and said, oh, I am one, but I don't feel like one.
Yeah, that's a good recognition.
Yes,
you talk in the piece about tactics, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's your show, Battle Tactics. What are we going to do about it? But before you get to tactics, you kind of have to talk about causes,
right?
And here's someone who's a PhD psychologist, and maybe she's realizing there what, as you say in the episode, what our brains will do to us.
Yes, yes, which. You know, I characterize it a little bit as our brains messing with us.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We talked to a neurologist who says that our brains are essentially prediction machines, and we are all at some point going to be in a circumstance where we don't know what we're doing. And so the sort of bodily responses we have to that, like our palms getting sweaty, our heartbeat going up, all of that stuff, we we can associate that with not being prepared. So then every time we have that bodily experience of, you know, our heart rate going up, our palms being sweaty, I felt it when I walked in here. I thought, okay, but the thing that it's not is my body and brain telling me, you are not prepared for this. You are a fraud and you should not do this interview. What my body is doing is preparing me for something. And so if I can tell my, if I can retrain my brain to say, you know what, you're preparing yourself for battle. That's what's happening. It's not that you're not ready. It's that you're preparing for something that's important. And there's a difference between those two things. It makes a really big difference. I mean, I can say over the course of my career, I have been able to tell myself, you are feeling sweaty and shaky right now because your body is preparing yourself for what's to come. That's it. It's not because you're not prepared, and it's not because you're not good enough.
Yeah, but we can go to those stories that we've been told and that we've told ourselves for
very
so long.
Easily. Very
and,
easily.
And interpret it as, I'm flustered, I'm jittery, I'm obviously ill-prepared
exactly.
and weak and on and on.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sometimes, because I have felt imposter syndrome.
I wanted
you know?
To ask
oh,
you this.
Yeah. I mean, you and I worked on it on this comedy show together, Rewind. I never thought I was funny. I didn't, and I would listen to people. I would believe the people who hated the show because they knew what they were talking about. The people who liked it, I would explain it away as, well, you know, they love public radio, so of course they love anything that comes out of my mouth. Or, well, they love something that Jeannie did. They loved a sketch that you produced that was hilarious, or John Moe wrote something funny, and I'm just barely keeping this thing. You know, eventually I'm going to be found out. You know, I'm just kind of keeping things up in the air. Do you see what I mean? I'm going to keep fooling the crowd.
Nobody can see me. My mouth is hanging open because never in a million years would I have guessed that you felt that way when I worked with you. I look to you as a model for how to keep the work moving and how to keep myself bringing ideas to the table during that time, because I had the least experience of anybody on that team.
Yeah. Well, but to me, I would look at what you were doing and like, thank God for Jeannie and John Moe and Dave Snyder and David Garriman and all our people.
Yes.
But you know what? One thing I did in a way over time was reframe it as, you know what I am good at is getting great people like Jeannie and John and Dave and Ian, you know, that, okay, I'm honestly not the funniest guy, but I think I started to shift to an identity of what I can do well. Is that a useful tactic to kind of sometimes just to be humble? It's okay to be humble.
Oh, yeah.
Figure out, but give yourself some credit.
There are two really good tactics in there. So one is to, you talked about the story we can tell ourselves.
Yeah.
So one story you could tell yourself is you can talk about how you are the hero of your story, right? Like you face trials and tribulations like literally every hero, Spider-Man, Hercules, everybody faces it, right? Wonder Woman, we all have trials and tribulations. But the thing is, what's brave and amazing is we come through it. We keep trying. And that's basically what you were doing in reframing that story.
Mm. Well, thank you, Gene.
Yeah, I have another tactic, but I know there's a phone call.
Yeah, Frank is here from Bainbridge. Frank, what's your story, please, of an imposter syndrome?
This is a really close to my heart kind of tale. I was invited to a very well-known Silicon Valley confab in 2012. Some really powerful Silicon Valley moguls invite 200 deep thinkers. And immediately when I got the invite, I thought, there's no way. Like, I don't fit. Mm. And I'm not a deep thinker and I don't belong. And I'd gone my entire professional career incredibly embarrassed about my education. I actually had left high school. I never went to higher education. And I always dreaded that someday that would be found out. And at this conference, there was a conversation about what our influences were and where we went to school. And it just slipped out that I didn't go. And instead of being completely, you know, humiliated, as I'd always imagined that would go, I got a sort of warm embrace and I really enjoyed it. And then at the penultimate session of the conference, they asked the new people what was the most important thing they had learned. And I said that I had gone my entire life with this fear, this incredible imposter syndrome, and that I felt really embraced and I thought it was great. I was embarrassed and I sat down. And the next person to get up was a really well-known Bollywood actress. And she looked right at me and said, in, you know, an accent I can't do, she said, well, watch this. And she turned to the audience and said, over the last 3 days, these are 200 incredibly smart people, so much smarter than me. She says, over the last 3 days at this conference, how many of you have felt imposter syndrome? And I think maybe 9 out of 10 people raised their hands.
Right.
And I felt, I thought at that moment, I was like, oh my God, I've found my tribe. I'm so happy.
Yes, maybe it's all of us. Frank, we're just up at the end of this hour. Frank, thanks so much for that phone call.
Thank you so much. What a great story. Fantastic stuff.
What a great topic for battle tactics for your sexist workplace. Final words, Jeannie?
All I want to say, Frank, is you got where you were, and another tactic is you get there. You might not think you're qualified. Okay, great. Earn it in reverse. You're there. Show how amazing you are now, what great ideas you have, and how you can work it, which you totally did. Also, the numbers are on your side.
Yeah, as we found out,
80-90%.
Yes. Jeannie Yandel and Eula Scott Bino host Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace wherever you get your podcasts. Jeannie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And thank you to Amin Al-Sadi, Ajua Jim Abrempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. See you for more of The Record tomorrow.